Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Malls have gone empty. The airlines are full. Testosterone rules. Berlusconi does too. Get a cell phone in Cuba. They're legal today. I learned it all on that radio show. That's right. It's The Takeaway.
God, I love radio.
All across the USA, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Oh my, John. Here's my thought.
I don't think
that you would be winning any awards for that song, and my advice would be to keep your day job.
Thank you for that advice. Thanks for that.
In terms of real country music, we'll be talking about the Country Music Television Awards today.
That's good. Also,
we'll take a look at the latest on the airline mergers. Overnight, the boards of Northwest Airlines and Delta have agreed the two should merge. We'll ask an industry insider what that means for travelers. Good news or bad news, John? Also, on the economic front, bankruptcies are up for consumers and businesses, and that means more work for bankruptcy lawyers. And in Cuba, the new leader, Raul Castro, says it's okay for Cubans to own cell phones for the first time ever, and more changes there are on the way.
In other headlines today, in Iraq, there have been at least three car bombs across the country. In Bakuba, at least 37 people are dead. In Ramadi, at least 14 have died. And in Baghdad, one person has been killed. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is unveiling new hedge fund guidelines today, choosing industry-developed best practices over official government regulations. Millions of Americans have their pensions invested in hedge funds.
And in Texas, some of the mothers of the more than 400 children taken from a polygamous ranch are talking publicly. They say they were separated from their children during raids last week. Brenda, one of the mothers, says it was terrifying.
They took us into this room and said, "This is our decision. This is what we are going to do." And then they brought in their lines of officers. "If you resist, we will arrest you."
The sect is blaming a bitter outsider for the complaint that triggered the raids. The U.S. is making $200 million available for aid to help food shortages in Africa and other parts of the world. The White House says the money would be used to deal with skyrocketing prices for foods like wheat and rice.
Devout Catholics are making the pilgrimage to the East Coast this week for a chance to see the Pope as he begins a six-day visit to the United States. President Bush will greet Pope Benedict at Andrews Air Force Base when the Pope lands this afternoon, and that's a gesture the president hasn't made for any other world leader. And it's April 15th. According to the Taxpayers Union, most of us are spending more than a day and more than a couple $100 to prepare our tax returns this year. The group says Congress, not the IRS, is to blame because they keep complicating the laws.
Did you file?
I filed. Of course I filed.
Oh, I didn't.
But if taxes make you miserable, then you need a song for it. The Takeaway is here for you. We have our very own guitar-strumming cowboy in the studio today. Jack Grace is with us. We're going to have some fun with him. We're going to talk about the Country Music Television Awards, but we're also going to get you to countrify songs for us, because the takeaway today is, think of a song that can't possibly be countrified, like Beethoven's Ninth, Ode to Joy.
Can you do that one,
Ode
Jack?
Ode to Joy.
Well, I would say that we want to have lyrics in a song.
So Ode to Joy.
First, what we have to do is
sing a song of joy. You got 5 seconds. Jack, why don't you think about it? We have to go away.
I'm going into it.
What, you're going think about it. We'll do a little Beethoven here. But what can be made into a country song, or what could never be made into a country song? That's my take at thetakeaway.org. We'll be right back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In an industry in steep descent, mergers seem to be the only way to stay aloft for some airlines. The latest largest airline in the world looks to be the combined Delta and Northwest. They announced a stock swap deal yesterday that still needs approval by some key unions. The new airline will be called Delta. Rick Cini from faircompare.com joins us now. Does the fact that this is an all-stock deal, Rick, suggest that both of these recently bankrupt carriers are really desperate to combine or die?
I think it's more of a reflection of the times that we're in right now with record fuel costs and looming economy issues that are out there. So really, bigger is better, and survival of the fittest is really a management directive nowadays.
Is this going to be a good thing for the customers of Northwest and Delta? I mean, it's going to be based in Atlanta. I'm a little worried about what's going on at the Northwest hubs in Detroit and Minneapolis.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, overall, basically, anytime you reduce competition, overall for consumers, it's going to be bad because competition is basically what drives prices, and most consumers really are buying on price today when it comes to tickets. So, you know, overall, it's bad. In the short term, there's really not likely to be much issue. Their route systems barely even overlap, only about 10 city pairs out of the top 1,200 city pairs in the U.S. So it's not really a big overlap, so there's not much of an issue there. Certainly, you know, there's issues in and around the northern area where Northwest had a virtual lock on all flights. They say that they're not going to remove any of the hub system, but obviously, you know, with Atlanta having hubs in Cincinnati and also in Salt Lake and a big one in Atlanta, there's no doubt there's probably going to be some scale back in those hubs in Minneapolis and Detroit.
So because of the lack of overlap, we're really talking about new coats of paint for some planes and a lot of layoffs, right?
I think what you'll see is, you know, that they've stated that they're going to have $1 billion in savings, and really what that means is it's mostly the white collar staff. You're talking about people that are working on the websites, a combined reservation system, combining the back offices, accounting systems, and all that's where you're going to see the most savings. I mean, they're basically going to fly the same number of flights, same number of pilots, same number of flight attendants.
You know, you raise the pilots. Let's talk about that for a second. The pilots really are the ones that can actually kill this deal, and they've been instrumental in some other merger deals. How likely are the pilots to actually shut this down?
Well, I don't think they necessarily can shut it down, but they certainly can cause a lot of pain and agony. U.S. Airways' America West merger is still dealing with pilot issues, even this is since 2005, so it could, you know, be a prolonged issue there. Delta's pilots seem to be on board, and there's definitely a few sounds of, you know, conciliation on Northwest side. So I don't see that necessarily being a huge deal. I think, you know, you've got Oberstar with, you know, the hearings on safety out of Minneapolis. You've got the governor now saying there's a $250,000 bond that Delta may have to forfeit on.
A penalty if they move out of the Northwest hub, right, the Minneapolis hub.
Issues they're going to have to plow through.
All right, Rick. Well, thanks for joining us. Rick Cini from faircompare.com, who is our analyst on the airline industry. Just a reminder, Delta and Northwest, when combined, will have a annual revenue of $31.7 billion.
Wow.
And not much profit in that money.
That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money.
Not much profit.
I'm sorry to hear that there isn't good news in there, but we'll see how this all plays out. There is some good news, though, for bankruptcy lawyers. They are one group enjoying a boom in this tight economy. That means there are thousands of consumers filing. And adding to those troubles, more and more companies are taking a fall. Several high-profile chain stores are broke. Bombay and Linen and Things are just two. Other chains like Foot Locker, Borders, and Circuit City say they're downsizing. One industry group says nearly 5,600 stores will close in 2008, and that's up 25% from last year. Michael Barbaro, that also means thousands of people are losing their jobs, right?
Yeah, something like 11,000 retail workers may be losing their job from these eight bankruptcies.
Michael Barbaro is covering the story for the New York Times. We're really talking about mid-sized chains, right? From furniture stores like Levitt's to electronic stores like Sharper Image.
Yeah, most of these are regional retailers, not the big national players. And basically what's happened is that these stores have begun acting like a lot of the customers they complain about who spend way beyond their means. And banks and other lenders are cutting up these stores' credit cards and without any extra money, they go into bankruptcy.
And how do we measure what the collateral damage will be? For example, you say in your story that Sharper Image actually owes UPS $6.6 million. Now, is the post office, are they ever going to get that money? And there must be all kinds of other ancillary businesses that support what these stores do.
I'll give you a really great example. The New York Times is owed about $500,000 from Fortunoff, a funny thing we stumbled into in the bankruptcy filings. The reality is that most creditors never get paid in these kinds of bankruptcies. So whether it's a small shipping company in Arizona or something like UPS, which is owed tens of millions of dollars, generally they're paid pennies on the dollar.
Now, is this, John and I were talking about this earlier, and he was just wondering, is this a macro issue? In other words, are some of these stores that I already mentioned, plus JCPenney's and Lowe's Office Depot, they're downsizing. Is this going to be a new reality?
It is to a certain degree, and in certain industries. You know, the furniture retailing industry is definitely going to shrink. The housing market is tanking. There's just no reason for so many regional furniture chains to exist. There's no demand. Or there's a lot less demand, so it's going to be shrinking. But when it comes to discounters, there's evidence that Walmart and other chains are doing quite well, and they're going to continue to expand. A lot of chains, for example, Lowe's, are just pausing their expansion. They're going to sort of wait and see. For example, they might be opening a store in California or in Florida where the housing market is really in turmoil, and they're saying, let's wait until things calm down a bit, then we'll build that 100,000-square-foot store we were talking about.
Because, of course, everyone wants to see if this spending on gas and food, which, with those things rising, is crowding out other things. The question is how long that will last, right?
It's going to last for a while. There's no sign that food prices and gasoline prices are going to fall, and when you're spending that much money on the bare necessities, you don't have an appetite on Friday and Saturday and Sunday to go to the mall and splurge on new luggage, new bedding, you know, a new coat. It just doesn't exist. So that's a terrible burden for the department store industry and the furniture retail industry.
But what's really fascinating here is that bigger stores, or I should say high-end stores like Saks Fifth Avenue, you say are less vulnerable to this this economic situation.
Yeah, well, the rich keep getting richer for the most part, and they're spending pretty freely. Actually, the New York Times had a very interesting story a couple days ago about this. People are still buying luxury cars, luxury houses, and taking luxury vacations. Of course, this is an incredibly small subset of consumers who shop at a particular kind of store, whether it's Saks Fifth Avenue, Neiman Marcus, and the like. The average consumer.
But I'm glad they're doing okay, Michael. I'm feeling good about it.
We all are. Yeah. No bitterness here.
Yeah.
But on the other end, Walmart's doing well. So there, in American retail, there's always a barbell. There are people at the bottom who are helping Walmart do really well. There are people at the top who are helping Neiman Marcus do really well. It's the middle that always gets squeezed, and that's absolutely happening right now. If you're at Macy's right now, you're not very happy. You're right in the middle, and your consumer is feeling squeezed, and your sales are going down.
Michael Barbaro from the New York Times, let me ask you one last question before you go. Do you think there are any country songs, or do you think there are any songs, period, that cannot be countrified?
Oh, that's a very, very good question.
Impossible to countrify song, quickly.
Possible to countrify
impossible.
Song.
Impossible.
Impossible.
Happy birthday.
Happy. Nice. Nice.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, Michael.
To you.
Well, you nailed that one. Jack Grace is in our studio. He's our strumming cowboy today. We're talking about the Country Music Television Awards, and we also have challenged you come up with a song that can never possibly be made into a country song. Here's one suggestion from a listener. Can you countrify REO Speedwagon's I Can't Fight This Feeling?
Oh, that's so easy. You take it on the run, baby. You're gonna get a bye, baby.
Okay, that was easy. That was an easy one. Do we have something hard? Here's somebody.
Good job.
Somebody from Indiana, of course, says, how about Journey, Don't Stop Believing? Let's hear it. Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. Okay, bring it out. Countrify right. That, dude.
Well, we're already starting with that. Just a small town girl, living in a country world. I mean, come on. It's already served to me.
We're going to have some harder ones. We're going to have some harder ones for you later in the hour. And we want people to pick their impossible to countrify songs.
Yes.
Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I don't know. I don't think we're going to be able to stump Jack the Martini.
You got to come up with some, like, you know. Race. You got to come up with some Luther Vandross or something.
No, but those are no.
Barry White. You can't countrify Barry White.
I bet
bring
you.
It on.
I bet
bring
you
it on. Bring it on. Jack Grace is in the studio. Of course, me and Adora are here. We'll be right back.
You can email us at talkback@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 800-543-2543.
543-2543. Femi, okay, you are here with the headlines. What's happening in the world today?
Delta Airlines reached an agreement on Monday with Northwest Airlines to take over Northwest and create the world's biggest carrier. Delta said the combined airline will be worth over $17 billion. John McCain wants the federal government to stop gas taxes this summer in response to the troubled economy. The Republican presidential nominee called on Congress to institute a gas tax holiday by suspending the gas tax from Memorial Day to Labor Day. Bob Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, says Barack Obama would not be a leading presidential candidate if he were white. The Charlotte Observer reported that Johnson also said that Obama's campaign has a hair trigger on anything racial. Johnson is one of
What is going on with him? What is going on with Johnson? I mean, it's like, Geraldine Ferraro says that, and she gets her head cut off, and then he's like prancing around saying, I don't understand. Yeah. Sorry.
Let me just tell you what his affiliation is.
Well, I know. He's BET. Yeah. He's the, he's the BET billionaire.
And a very big supporter of Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton, yeah.
Italy's centre-right leader Silvio Berlusconi warned of tough months ahead for the country as he takes over as the new prime minister. He's won a third term in office. And finally, J.K. Rowling is in New York, not for a public appearance, but for a court appearance. She testified before a packed courtroom in a lawsuit to block publication of a Harry Potter encyclopedia, telling a judge that it amounts to wholesale theft of nearly 20 years of her hard work.
If books that plagiarise other works are permitted, authors, fans and readers stand to lose.
Rowling claims the encyclopedia
called Get a Life.
It's not called Get a Life.
I don't blame her.
It's called the Harry Potter Lexicon.
She came up with it. She owns it.
And this just in, I have a song. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Can't be countrified. Okay, we're out of time, but that's a good one.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. This is a little segment we like to call
Hormones and Boys.
Or Hormones and Traders. When you make a risky bet, you can feel the adrenaline. When the bet goes bad, you can feel the loser juices in your gut. Add up all the risky bets and safe bets, and you've got the modern trading economy. Add up all the juices, and you've got quite a hormonal soup coursing through the markets. Well, John Coates was once a trader at Deutsche Bank, and on a particularly riotous day, thought hard about the connection between hormones and market fluctuations. So he eventually ditched investment banking, went to the University of Cambridge, and designed a study to look at levels of testosterone and cortisol in traders. John, good morning, and what did you find?
Well, we went in with a big hypothesis, and that was that these two steroids were, at extreme levels, were exaggerating market moves, maybe destabilizing the financial system. The study, of course, couldn't test for a hypothesis that big, so we were looking at something much more specific. We just wanted to see whether these two steroids were actually responding to profit and loss in the markets and to volatility. And what we found was that when these traders, we sampled steroids from traders over a two-week period, 17 of them. And we found that when they had high testosterone in the morning, they made considerably more money for the rest of the day than they did on days when they had low testosterone. And equally, when the volatility of their trading results went up and the volatility of the market went up, then their cortisol went up.
So what do you think is going on here? Does the testosterone help them in their predictive skills, or does it help them actually pull the trigger when they're faced with a risky decision?
That's an excellent question. We don't know. Right now, we don't know. We've got a correlation, or rather a prediction, but the effect of testosterone on the brain that study is in its infancy. We think, based on some previous work, both with animals and humans, that it may increase their confidence. It might increase their risk preferences, might increase search persistence, and possibly cognitive speed, but not accuracy.
You know, economists like to talk about risk aggregation and that there are points in the market where everybody takes a certain risk, and when that risk accumulates to too high a point, the market can collapse, there can be bubbles that burst, that sort of thing. How do you think this manifests itself? And I know it's speculative, but how do you think it manifests itself on a macro scale?
Well, we think, and I mean, that's why we started the research in the first place, was to answer questions like that. We think that during market rallies, we think testosterone goes up with a gain in the market. In fact, that's one of the results of the study. And as it goes up, as you're winning money, it shifts your risk preferences. And if everyone were to get into sync, as they would during a bubble, we think these steroids can actually start rising quite quickly in your body and shifting your risk preferences quite dramatically towards more risk-taking, and we think that can lead to a bubble.
So what do we do? We, like, change the shift right at that point in the trading and get a lot of old men in there, or maybe some grandmothers, or
play
a lot of show tunes during the trading day?
Well, in the old days, I think you had pretty seasoned trading managers who would recognize the signs and would tell people to go home at the appropriate points. I don't know. I think you can. It's not hard. We were doing some fairly sophisticated assay work on these steroids, but you don't really need to. A good trading manager just take one look at these traders and say, look, stop it.
It's the bulging eyes and the swagger.
John, quick question for you. Can't you take these results, though, and extrapolate it to any stressful, high stressful job, whether you're a surgeon or whether you're a construction worker, that surge of adrenaline keeps you focused, allows you to plow through whatever anxiety or doubt you might have?
Well, I mean, adrenaline's a very different hormone from testosterone. It's a very short-acting hormone. It only lasts a few minutes in your body. And it's generally responds in your body when you're faced with a challenge. Getting a testosterone high is very different from getting an adrenaline high.
You know, I think this is a pretty fascinating result because I usually think this stuff, quite frankly, is a lot of malarkey. Were you surprised at the result you got here? That it was seemingly so definitive?
You mean that the stats were just incredibly
strong?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yes, I was. I was expecting preliminary data for a larger study. Every statistical result is significant to three decimal places, and the effect sizes are large. So I was just surprised by that. The other thing that really surprised me, and I think it's important to point out, is this connection we found between high morning testosterone levels and better trading results for the rest of the day. That sort of conjures up image of testosterone-driven cavemen on the trading floor.
Yeah, it does, actually, in fact.
They're just not like that at all. These guys, they were poker-faced and tight-lipped and got angry less than normal people. You'd never guess that this was going on. And if you had to compare them to anybody in another field, I would compare them to like a Roger Federer or a Tiger Woods, someone who's just extremely skilled at doing this job and is very controlled about it.
I'm sorry, John, but there's someone with a lot of estrogen who's telling me that I have to wrap this up and move on here in the studio. But, John, that's fascinating. That's really, really great. I love that scientific study. I'd love to hear where you're going to take this, but we'll talk to you again. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's John Coates of the University of Cambridge, studying cortisol and testosterone in traders. And why do we have to wrap that up? I thought that was very, very interesting. Okay, we have a guitar in the studio. We have Charles from Grand Rapids, Michigan, saying a song that cannot be countrified is the Yes tune Roundabout. Let's hear it. Okay.
Okay, I'll do it like this.
It's hard.
Yep. I'll be the roundabout. You get to see
this
All right, this guy is good.
I got one for you, though.
All right, let's do some hip.
I got one for you. Yeah, Chris from San Jose, California, says, try this one.
I was waiting for a rap.
Busta Rhymes, put your hands where my hands can see them.
So
now I have to know the words of it in order to get it through. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use one of the rap songs I know to show that how you break down. You just have to know the words.
I guess that's called improvising.
Yeah. So I'm going to take Rapper's Delight to show you how it goes.
That's an easy one. You can countryfy Rapper's Delight.
It's the same. You just got to know all the words.
You're changing the rules, pal.
Okay. Well, all right. Give us a taste.
You give me a rap sheet. No.
All right. All right.
Well, at a hip hop, the hibby to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop rockin' to the madman boogie. Set up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat.
That sounds pretty good. All right, Jack, we're going to be back with you in a second, but Femi's here, and I know she's got some headlines that she's dying to get out to us. Let's hear it.
Good morning to you all. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson today will unveil guidelines for operation of hedge funds that were developed by the industry itself. Millions of people are invested in them through their pension funds. Democrats in Congress are working on a new housing bill that would help struggling homeowners to trade in their mortgages, but participation will be voluntary. Some of the mothers at a polygamous ranch in Texas say they were forced to leave their children after state officials took custody of them. More than 400 children were taken from the compound almost 2 weeks ago after a 16-year-old girl complained of abuse. And in sports news, the NHL has moved very quickly to eliminate a method of screening used by New York Rangers forward Sean Avery against New Jersey Devils goaltender Martin Brodeur on Sunday night. Avery planted himself in front of Brodeur and face-guarded the netminder, waving his stick from side to side to further distract Brodeur. There had been no previous rules against such acts.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today we're following the latest news on the merger between Delta and Northwest Airlines. We're also taking a look at bankruptcies. They are up not only for consumers, but companies in the United States. And we're going to turn our attention now to Cuba, where for the very first time, they are being allowed to buy cell phones. Only 2 months into his rule, there are signs Raul Castro is going to be a far different head of state than his fabled big brother Fidel.
Is that his ringtone?
That is possibly Raul's his ringtone.
Did you find that?
No, I didn't find that. Sitara, our producer, she found that. She's good, I know. Fidel's rule was marked by heavy restrictions on behavior and access and travel. Raul, though, immediately committed himself to economic and social reforms when he took office at the end of February. And yesterday, Cubans lined up in the streets to get cell phones, which have been legalized for the very first time. And more serious changes are afoot, aren't they, Michael Voss?
Yes, they are, Adora. And boy, were there queues in central Havana yesterday, the first day that mobile phones had legally gone on sale. There were lines stretching both sides of the street to the telecommunications store that I visited. Cubans have been masters for years at getting round rules. Up until now, only key government workers and foreigners were allowed to own mobile phones. What lots of Cubans did was get foreigners to take out prepaid phones in their account and then hang on to them. And half the people in line yesterday were buying new phones for the very first time and excited about it. And the other half were all lining up with their phones in the names of foreigners to legally transfer them to their own name.
So they were very clever there for a while. Michael Voss is the BBC correspondent in Havana. Was there a sense of absolute excitement? Did it feel like this was inevitable? And how are people affording these phones? How much are they costing?
Well, they're costing, to get a line is about $120 and perhaps another $70 for the most basic mobile phone. Remember, this is a country where the average wage is under $20 a month. However, think of the number of Cubans there are living in the United States, for example, and there are many more living around in Spain or Central America and other countries. They're sending remittances back to relatives in Cuba. And that's how a lot of Cubans are able to afford these things. There's almost a class difference growing in Cuba between those with access to foreign currency and those without.
Let's talk about other reforms. I've read something about the possibility of there being a lifting of the travel restrictions. Is that true?
It's certainly something that the foreign minister, Perez Roque, did mention about 3 weeks ago. He said, roughly his words were, don't let me get ahead of myself, but it is something that we are discussing. So I think there is a possibility there that that travel restrictions could be lifted. That's perhaps the big one to come. People are still waiting to see if they'd be allowed to buy and sell cars. That's not allowed. Or buy and sell property, and that's not allowed. But how far down the road these sorts of changes are and whether they come is very difficult to say.
Michael, let's take a look at the big picture. Raul has generally been thought of as a hardliner. There's been accusations of him persecuting dissidents and homosexuals. He didn't quite have this air of a reformer, but he has stepped in and has immediately began changing things. Is this perception of him consistent? Are there expectations that he is truly going to change the way Cubans live?
I think the thing to remember about Raul is that, one, yes, he was a dedicated communist long before his brother Fidel, and as the world's longest-serving defense minister and head of the Cuban Armed Forces, is a tough man. But he's also a pragmatist. His brother Fidel is this great, is always ruled by ideology and great speeches, and Raul has a reputation of getting things done. Now, in this transitional period, the one thing that worries those in power at most at the moment is how to manage this transition without the system collapsing as it did in the Soviet Union.
Right.
No signs of any reforms to this one-party state, but the economy is in a mess. And I think Raul knows that if he doesn't put more food in people's pockets,
then it's not going to
money in people's pockets, food on the table, and give them some sort of opportunity to earn a bit more money.
Then he won't.
Be in trouble.
Then he won't keep his job. Michael Voss, BBC Stringer in Havana. Many thanks. Big changes there.
Yeah, well, you know, Cuba's always been on the verge, it seems like.
I think we're going to talk about country music now.
We got Jack. We got Jack Grace, Martini Cowboy from here in New York. But we want to talk about the actual awards ceremony that took place last night.
Yeah, last night it was for music videos, right?
It was indeed. It was the Country Music Television Awards.
And you've actually opened, just to give folks a sense of you, you've opened for some of the greats like Doc Watson and the Oak Ridge Boys.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some experience in country music. Tell us, what did you think of the show?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag, as many award shows go. There was a couple of highlights where some true, sincere moments happened, and then there was...
Give us a true and sincere moment.
A true and sincere moment was Tim McGraw and Faith Hill doing a duet. It was still about a half hour into the show, but it was the first moment that sounded country to me. And it
was
sincere.
We have that clip right here, actually.
All right.
I need you.
Young women being put to death there in the...
I wanna get lost in some corner booth.
That's the king and queen of country. That's about right.
There's many kings and queens of country, but those are two of them.
What was a low moment? And I want to add, folks, Jack has an amazing review of the entire show. That's on the website. You can check out his thoughts from beginning to end. But give us one of your hokier moments. You weren't too thrilled with the hosts, were you?
Well,
that was bad news.
It was. It was a husband, a father and daughter combination.
In
both
some states,
popular.
Husband-wife.
Yeah.
So, a very famous,
yeah.
Give us the names, a very famous.
Billy Ray Cyrus and Miley Cyrus.
You weren't too thrilled with them.
Well, I got to say, I kind of thought, you would think they would have a natural rapport together that they could sort of, because actually the writing that they gave them wasn't so bad. The skits were kind of funny, but they delivered them, dare I say, kind of like a... I've never seen any of these kind of movies, but sort of like porn acting.
Well, there's a kind of a tradition of going all crazy in front of the mic. Here's a moment from last night's show.
Oh my gosh, this is the first time I've ever won anything in my life. I'm so excited. I don't know what to say. Thank you, American Idol. You are the rocket that launched my career.
That's Kelly Picker winning an award there.
Yeah.
A former American Idol contestant.
I have a little sympathy for her because she was... via satellite. She was alone in a room in some hotel. Well, it must have been bizarre.
More about the awards when we come back.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
And Jack Grace is still with us. We were talking about the Country Music Awards, and we also had our assignment for people out there. We're trying to pick songs that can't be countrified, and we have this from Hermosa Beach, California, Walk This Way by Aerosmith. Let's hear it a little bit, Dylan. All right, can you countrify that, Jack?
Yes, sure can. Well, I took a big chance at the high school dance with a mister that was ready to play. She knew what she was doing and a little dirty turning, and I told her how to walk this way.
All right, that's marginal equality.
He's gotten us just about every time.
The Busta Rhymes thing. The Busta Rhymes thing didn't work at all.
I just need the lyrics.
Which raises a question, though. Basically a long time ago, and I'm thinking about these awards last night and all the kind of goofiness that went on, the pop goofiness. I mean, upon a time, country music was basically this, right?
Love is a burning thing.
Johnny Cash, Tammy Wynette. Now it's almost impossible to sort out the various genres and, you know, let's not forget the hair on some of these people.
Yeah.
I need an education, Jack. I mean, I've got a good grasp of Johnny Cash and maybe Dolly Parton. Where do I go from there to navigate this country music scene these days?
Well, it's sort of taken, it's broken into a new bunch of little subgroups now that I sort of wrote down here that I'm thinking, you know, there's just what I call shameless pop country.
Okay.
Which sounds like 80s music.
Shania Twain, something like
that. It's basically that. It sounds a lot like 80s rock, and maybe there's a little bit of a steel or a fiddle in there, and the lyrics stick a little more to, you know, talking about how daddy did this and daddy did that for me, and you know.
So Pat Benatar with a fiddle.
Well, you know, it's just, it also blends right in. I'm just going to move right to the next one.
Yeah, go to the next one,
because it goes right into family heartstring country, which is like, it's the same thing, but this is going to be more like a gentle song that is going to once again like be like, you know, daddy put me down on his shoulders, told me how it's going to be. You know, it's going to be a
who's
family
one of the,
story.
Who's one of the artists in that genre?
I picked for that one, I said Alan Jackson, who is very talented, but he is definitely guilty of doing a lot of like, you know, heartbreak family story
songs. You have a couple of other categories here, too.
Okay, then I came up with good old hunk country.
Oh, that Billy Ray Cyrus started that with Achy Breaky Heart, right?
He's definitely one of them, for sure.
Would Vince Gill fit in that?
I would think so.
Yeah.
I would think so. You know, I think Keith Urban goes in there, you know.
Oh, right, of course, yes. Yep.
What else?
Then I sort of, you know, then you've got your, what we sort of, we'll call it sex kitten country on the other
Shania
side.
That's Shania Twain.
That is definitely Shania Twain.
Well, but what's that about?
That's the answer to hunk country. It's just, you know, they work hand in hand, you know. There's
a beautiful woman with an amazing voice, which is what she has.
Yeah, it's sort of like in talking about how Tammy Wynette was a certain type of star. This is like, you know, that gone awry into way too much power and too much makeup and too much sparkle.
I got a question for
Elliot
you.
Elliot Spitzer music. So.
I want you to quickly complete this sentence. You can't be a country music fan unless, go ahead, Jack.
Quickly.
Unless you lack pretension.
What about you, John?
I can't be a country music fan unless you know Johnny Cash.
I think that's fair. I think that's an obvious answer.
What, we're out of time. I don't know when I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have lots on our plate this morning. News that Delta and Northwest Airlines, the merger has been approved by the board, so they're one step closer. Bankruptcies are up for consumers and companies. We're also following a story about Cuba, where for the very first time, Cubans have been able to buy cell phones legally. Now we're going to head to Los Angeles in the world of Hollywood. When the writers dropped their pencils and took to the picket lines for 100 days, I'm sure you remember that, the Movio studios had a plan, stock up on scripts. Now, It's the actors. They are threatening a strike of their own. But there's one difference here. You can't stockpile actors. Jonathan Handel, a Hollywood entertainment attorney, says it's a brewing labor battle. Jonathan, what's at stake here?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And what's at stake really is shutting down the entire business because, as you say, you can't stockpile actors. And it looks like you can't get actors to agree on things either because there are two actors' unions in Hollywood, the Screen Actors Guild, SAG, and AFTRA, which is another union. They typically negotiate their contract together, but they've been at each other's throats. And AFTRA says, you know what, you guys, SAG, are starting your negotiations today. You've got 2 weeks. And then AFTRA is going to start its negotiations. And if SAG hasn't done a deal in that time, AFTRA is going to undercut them, probably.
Why are they at each other's throats?
Well, it's tough to say. There are sort of differences in philosophy, among other things. AFTRA is a bit more moderate and says, you know what, if we don't do deals that management can readily accept, production may go to Canada. SAG says it's a union's job to get as much as they can for its members.
Well, that sounds like a fundamental difference there. What kind of bargaining powers, though, do the actors really have?
Well, it's an interesting thing. If they were bargaining together, there would be the real threat of a strike. But SAG's leverage is undercut by knowing that AFTRA could do a deal in a matter of days if SAG doesn't. So that is a disincentive to strike. Not to say that there won't necessarily be one, but it really reduces the likelihood. We'll know more in a few days, perhaps.
How does this all, what's gone on in the last 6 months, the writer's strike and then later the director's negotiations that went fairly smoothly as compared to the writers, how does this affect how the actors' union moves forward from here?
Well, there are a lot of moving parts, and the big issue for the actors, and really SAG and AFTRA, is the same as the issue for the writers and the directors, which is new media. How does talent get compensated when things are rerun on the Internet? And what about productions that are created originally for the Internet? What kind of compensation is there for that?
And so that those are obviously critical issues in the world of entertainment because it's all about content, right, and how those principals are rewarded for their participation in it. What's your best guess as to which direction those talks will go in?
Well, there's no doubt that they're going to use the writers and directors deal on new media as a template. But the question is the Screen Actors Guild going to push for a lot more, a lot better deal, or indeed a deal that doesn't use that as a template? And management has said no. We're going to give you the same deal, and that's the end of the matter.
Jonathan, I have a quick question, though. I think you got this wrong. You can stockpile actors. I mean, isn't that what Disney does with the Mouseketeers? Aren't they stockpiling actors?
Well,
and Menudo, isn't that stockpiling actors? Power Rangers, that's stockpiling actors. Pixar stockpiles actors.
You know, you can, but there's a couple things. One is you can't stockpile celebrities.
Ah.
And the other is when actors are on strike, all the Mouseketeers are on strike, and we won't see any of them on the air.
Okay, Jonathan Handel, entertainment attorney with Troy Gold. Did I say that right, Jonathan?
You certainly did, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We'll be talking to you, no doubt, soon. Well, there's always news in the land of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Femi, okay? Where else is there news today?
We have news from Baghdad. It's been one of the deadliest days in Iraq for months. More than 50 killed. Car bombs tore through crowded areas during the lunch hour in the former insurgent strongholds of Bakuba and Ramadi. The world's biggest airline is worth over $17 billion. Delta Airlines reached an agreement on Monday with Northwest Airlines to take over Northwest and Delta and create one super carrier. One passenger at Atlanta's airport says she isn't worried about less competition because ticket prices are already very high. In his first visit to the US as Pope, Benedict will get the presidential treatment. The Pontiff's jet will land this afternoon at Andrews Air Force Base, the first time the president has greeted a foreign leader at the steps of their aircraft. Here's Dana Perino, the White House press secretary, on the Pope's visit.
He shares a lot of common values with Catholics across America, across the world, from freedom and human rights and a culture of life.
The Pope is visiting Washington and New York on this trip.
Femi, isn't being treated like a president a downgrade for a pope? Isn't that a bit of a downgrade for a pope?
If President Bush comes to greet you at
well,
the...
I mean, if it's me, it's an upgrade, okay? But for the pope, it's a downgrade. I mean, it's like,
I think it's very courteous of him.
I suppose. I don't know.
Sounds
like a downgrade to me.
Do I have time for one more, sir?
No, you don't, actually.
Ah, you always say that.
Don't.
I always
you
have more news.
No, you don't have more time. You don't
later.
Have time. Thank
okay.
you, Femi.
Bye.
We're going to do a quick foreign story in the last part of this segment. Once upon a time, Italy, of course, was known for burning through new governments like a chain smoker, sometimes two per year. But these days, a kind of strange continuity has settled on Rome. Billionaire Silvio Berlusconi returns as prime minister for the third time. He won a hard-fought election and takes the government amidst some considerable turmoil. Franco Pavoncello joins us from John Cabot University, where he's a political scientist. Is there continuity in Italy, Professor?
I think there is fairly much continuity. I think the governments that have been alternating in the past 15 years have always been led by the same two people. It was Prodi and then Berlusconi. And so we're back to Berlusconi now.
Why doesn't Berlusconi get more of the blame for the economic difficulties that are taking place in Italy right now? I mean, the deficit, the problems with the currency, and you know, the serious sort of economic problems in employment.
Well, I think that the last 2 years of the Prodi government, which was a center-left government, really focused the blame on them rather than Mr. Berlusconi. He came in with a very strong coalition, and among the parties in that coalition, there was the Northern League, which has obtained a lot of the protest vote. So I think that he enjoyed the disaffection of the voters with the government of Prodi and the center-left.
When do you think we're going to see signs of a real power shift in Italy, or is it going to bounce back and forth like this for another couple of elections?
Well, that is a very good question. I think that the Italians seem to have really taken a liking to this alternation. But, you know, I think that Mr. Berlusconi has a very good chance this time with the kind of victory he's had to last a while. So if the center-right really pulls a good show, he might continue. Also because for the first time since 1944, there are no communist party in parliament, right, in
right.
Italy.
Interesting. Well, the Italians are endorsing the two-party system there in Italy. Franco Pavoncello, thank you very much for joining us. He's a political scientist at John Cabot University. That's a great story in Italy. I think it's interesting. A two-party system in Italy.
I heard it here first. I was actually surprised that Silvio won again because he seemed to go out with a bit of a cloud last time.
Well, it was a very entertaining campaign. Very entertaining.
Speaking of entertainment...
Yeah, we've got it here. We got more responses. All right, more impossible to countrify songs in our last few minutes, Jack. Here's one that I think you're going to have some real difficulty with. I'm not even going to tell you. Jeff from Atlanta sent this from Britney Spears. We don't have that one, but I'm going to stump you.
Okay.
All right, I picked this one because I knew it would stump you. All right,
yeah.
Here's a song from a song, catchy tune from composer John Cage. Check this out. Can you countryfy that? You don't have to try.
I'm going to try right now. It's going to be quick part like this. I'm going to say like this.
He got you.
It's a little Charles Ives.
He
I think
got
that's
you,
good.
But I understand that you have the lyrics now of that Busta Rhymes song.
Yes, I'll have to use the word expletive a few times.
Okay, well, yeah, don't
yes,
say
no,
that.
No, that's, I mean, that's the
don't
word I'm going
curse
to use.
Words. Okay.
A new show.
Okay, let's see. I think we'll make it a ballad. I think it would be nice.
Oh, yeah. Flip mode, here we come. About to bust and explode. Flip mode, bust a bus. 9-7, hot expletive, ha ha.
Perhaps we're seeing here, Jack, why it is that you are available to come in here in the morning and do
He's
this.
He's brilliant. You are brilliant.
Well,
we didn't stump
you. Are
John,
fearless. You
John
are fearless.
Wanted to stump you badly.
Yeah.
And
well, I did
we've
with
gone
it.
An entire hour, and you've met every challenge. Congratulations,
I have
Jack.
Been sort of cheating. I've been pretty much as we'll say, we'll use the term cashifying all these things. I haven't delved into too many other people's style for this, but it is always the funnest way is to cashify them.
Well, Jack, thanks for being with us on this show. You can see the video of Jack Grace strumming his stuff at thetakeaway.org, where we've also posted all these songs, and we're going to be collecting more of your songs, so keep the suggestions coming. Check out what other people are sending in. We may have a chance later this week to even do another e-segment on Impossible to Countrify songs.
Oh, absolutely, and you should definitely check out his notes on the Country Music Video Awards from last night.
Right. We're looking for your tax day photos. The lines at the post office are getting longer by the hour. We're looking for the longest line. Send your pictures and stories of the post office melee to thetakeaway.org. Melee.
Ooh, you're not going to live that one
and
down.
But we've been talking about Cubans lining up.
And you're taking my lines, excuse me.
Sorry.
And we've been talking about Cubans, lining up to get their first ever cell phones.
Taking my lines.
Check out a slideshow of the frenzy over there. It's fascinating. A glimpse into a world we rarely get to see, including a picture of Fidel Castro trying one out for himself. I don't believe that. Who wrote that?
No, it's great.
There's a producer
it's a
who's making up stuff.
No,
here.
It's a beautiful slideshow.
Did you see a picture of Fidel with his cell phone?
I mean, there are changes taking place in Cuba.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's amazing.
And you can
amazing.
See the pictures. I mean, that's sort of the miracle of the web. We're also following today's stories, the violence in Baghdad, the airline merger, and the Pope's first pilgrimage to the U.S. right here on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is produced in association with the BBC World Service, the New York Times, and WGBH Boston.
PRI, Public Radio International.